It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. One of the most significant and impactful pieces of legislation advancing women's rights was passed just over 50 years ago in June 1972. Tucked away in the omnibus bill called the Education Amendments of 1972 was a provision referred to as Title IX. Opening educational opportunities to girls and women was the intended goal, but what wasn't anticipated was the undeniable impact Title IX would have on girls and women participating in sports at all levels. Over the next several months, I will bring the story of Title IX to you, from the beginning whispers in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, to the rapid, although tedious, progress of defining and expanding girls and women's right to have equal athletic opportunities, to the changing scope of how the law is applied. Along the way, you'll hear from women who have witnessed the radical change in how we value girls and women's sports and the opportunities they have enjoyed due to Title IX. In the first part of this episode, we'll start with some history, and you might be surprised to hear that elected officials from Alaska and Hawaii played key roles in the passage and extension of Title IX. In the second half of the show, you'll hear from Chloe Ivanoff, a former Kodiak High School All-American wrestler who was also an All-American wrestler in college. She brought her passion for wrestling home after college and is now running wrestling camps for girls from all parts of Alaska. Keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. Understanding how Title IX came to be requires a refresher on civil rights legislation, going back to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The legislation, initially proposed by President John F. Kennedy in 1963, was being opposed by a filibuster in the Senate at the time that JFK was assassinated. President Lyndon B. Johnson took up the cause in the wake of Kennedy's assassination and pushed it forward in the face of significant opposition. The Senate again filibustered the act for 72 days before finally passing it on a 73-27 vote. The House final vote was 290-130. The final passage of the Civil Rights Act meant that discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin in public places, schools, and employment is prohibited. What might be surprising to learn is that the word sex was not included in the original writing of the bill. There's some debate over why the word sex came to be included in the bill before it was passed. There's no doubt that there were many House members, particularly from the South, who were vehemently opposed to granting Black people civil rights protection. One of those House members was the chair of the Rules Committee, Congressman Howard Smith, a Democrat from Virginia. According to the National Archives, although Smith had supported an Equal Rights Amendment, he was looking for a way to derail the Civil Rights Act. So at the last minute, he proposed an amendment to include the word sex in the bill, thinking that it might keep members from voting in support of the act. It was specifically introduced to the Title VII section of the act that granted equal employment opportunity, the main battleground of women's rights up to that point. According to accounts, Smith's tone of voice implied it was a joke, and the amendment drew laughter from the House floor. A two-hour debate commenced, referred to as Ladies' Day. This is the popular interpretation of the events that led up to the inclusion of sex in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. However, it leaves out the decades of groundwork that many women and women's organizations had done up to that point. Also neglected is that there was a division among women leaders on if this was the appropriate path to equality. The proposed Equal Rights Amendment had been kicking around since 1923, and if passed, would give women protection against discrimination based on sex. Furthermore, many supporters of women's rights felt that discrimination based on race was much different than discrimination based on sex, and that the Civil Rights Act should be dedicated to protections against race-based discrimination only. The National Women's Party had been working toward the Equal Rights Amendment for decades. They lobbied to have sex included in the Civil Rights Act to promote the ERA to Congress. The NWP had been assured by key congresswomen that they would introduce sex as an amendment. However, Congressman Smith was seen as an ally who could potentially bring 100 Southern House members to a yes vote. Another motivation in adding sex was the worry that if sex wasn't included, then white women would have no protection in the workplace. Black women would be protected by their race from workplace discrimination, but white women would have no basis for protection. Regardless of the motivation of Congressman Howard Smith, Congresswoman Martha Griffiths, a Democrat from Michigan, and the first woman to serve on the Ways and Means Committee, said, quote, "If there had been any necessity to have pointed out that women were a second-class sex, the laughter would have proved it." The amendment passed, but it should be noted that this was only an amendment to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, the title that dealt with equal employment opportunities. The majority of the other titles dealt with voting rights, public accommodations, and desegregation, all relating to color and national origin. Title VI, Non-Discrimination in Federally Assisted Programs, only applied to race, color, and national origin. Sex and religion were not protected classes under Title VI. As part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, known as the EEOC, was established to enforce the act. However, executive orders and messages to Congress by President Johnson, while encouraging action on policies to support the Civil Rights Act, only referenced the act in terms of racial progress and neglected mentioning women at all. It became clear that the EEOC was doing nothing to address sex inequalities in the working world. The National Organization for Women, or NOW, which was formed in 1966 and essentially replaced the National Women's Party, continued to lobby President Johnson to include women as benefactors of the Civil Rights Act. Finally, in 1967, Johnson released an executive order that extended civil rights protection based on sex to government employees and federal contractors. The Education Amendments Act of 1972 was an omnibus bill to amend the Vocational Education Act of 1963, the General Education Provisions Act, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, and the Higher Education Act of 1965. The act is 147 pages long and amended public education policy in a wide range of areas: grants, loans, facilities, teachers, transportation. But what the act is remembered for is Title IX, Prohibition of Sex Discrimination. The simple opening of Title IX, "No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance." Remember, in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, sex had not been included as a protected class when it came to non-discrimination in federally assisted programs, including education. Johnson's 1967 executive order had extended protection to government employment and federal contracts, but women were continuing to face blatant and pervasive discrimination in education, from quotas on college admissions to employment opportunities at the university level. Bernice Sandler, now known as the godmother of Title IX, was a lecturer at the University of Maryland. She had been denied a promotion to a full-time position for which she was fully qualified. She acted by investigating sex discrimination at the university level, filing over 250 complaints. A congresswoman from Oregon, Edith Green, noticed Sandler's civil complaints and held the first ever congressional hearings on sex discrimination in education. Green had already made several attempts to introduce a Title IX type bill beginning in the 1969 to 1970 congressional session. The bill had no co-sponsors and never made it out of committee. In 1971, she resubmitted the bill for consideration in the 1972 Act. She had secured 7 Menes co-sponsors to move it out of committee. When it came before the full House, Patsy Takamoto Mink of Hawaii, who had contributed language to the bill, was recognized as the lead co-sponsor in the House, and Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana, who had also helped shape the bill, became the lead sponsor in the Senate. President Richard Nixon signed the bill into law on June 23, 1972. Title IX is now called the Patsy Takamoto Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act. Mink has often been called the mother of Title IX. However, it is really Edith Green who gave it life and should be recognized as the mother. Mink was more like an older sister. She protected Title IX during many challenges. Mink was the first woman of color and the first Asian American woman elected to Congress and the first woman Hawaii elected to a House seat. She served two stints in the House from 1965 to 1977 and again from 1990 to 2002. She died in 2002, the year of the 30th anniversary of Title IX. Her tireless advocacy on equal rights for women, her early involvement with the Title IX legislation, and her death in the 30th anniversary year of Title IX led Congress to rename Title IX in her honor. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. Today's show is about Title IX, the legislation that mandated women have equal opportunity in education and sports. The passage of Title IX did not mean that equal treatment of women in federally funded programs magically began. And in fact, there was an immediate and vigorous pushback, starting with the always reliable red herring that quotas would be imposed in university admissions. The irony of this argument was that universities had already been imposing quotas on women, limiting the number of women admitted into many degree programs. At this time, even though Title IX does not even mention sports, the backlash extended to collegiate sports, with opponents fearing that men's sports would be eliminated so that women's teams could be established. And in the 3 years after passage, but before a framework for enforcement was established, the most obvious and vigorous resistance to the law came from the university sports system. As of this broadcast, Title IX has had 42 actions directed towards refining, clarifying, and extending rights based on sex. These actions have come in the form of attempted amendments, Dear Colleague letters, which are Education Department clarifications, executive orders, lawsuits, and court orders. Compliance with Title IX is enforced by the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights, which has the power to pull federal funds from institutions that are not in compliance. It is estimated that 80 to 90% of universities are out of compliance in athletics, yet the OCR has never pulled federal funding from a single school. In the first years following the passage of Title IX, a three-pronged test for compliance in athletics was developed. In order to be in compliance, an institution had to meet one of the following standards. One, the number of male and female athletes is substantially proportionate to their respective enrollments. Or two, the institution has a history and continuing practice of expanding participation opportunities responsive to the developing interests and abilities of the underrepresented sex. Or the institution is fully and effectively accommodating the interests and abilities of the underrepresented sex. The three-pronged test has been refined and expanded since it was created, and publicly funded education institutions are now held accountable to all three updated standards. Number one, effective accommodation of student interests and abilities. Two, female and male student athletes must receive athletic scholarships proportional to their participation. And three, equal treatment in 11 provisions. Those 11 provisions are: one, equipment and supplies; two, scheduling of games and practice times; three, travel and daily allowance or per diem; four, access to tutoring; five, coaching; six, locker rooms, practice, and competitive facilities; seven, medical and training facilities and services; eight, housing and dining facilities and services; nine, publicity and promotions; 10, support services; and 11, recruitment of student athletes. The updated test for compliance eliminated the prong that essentially gave publicly funded educational institutes a soft pass. All they had to do was show that they were trying to comply over time. Institutions had been arguing that women were not interested in sports to justify offering fewer sports to women. A 1996 court ruling said that the use of interest as a justification had led to a catch-22. For instance, social constructs said that girls and women weren't interested in contact sports, so a sport like wrestling wouldn't be offered to girls and women, leading fewer girls and women to wrestle. However, as will become clear in the second part of today's show, it was really a build it and they will come Title IX sits on another basic tenet that there cannot be an economic justification for discrimination. In the 1990s, a major backlash to Title IX arose, mostly focused on men's sports teams, such as wrestling, being eliminated from universities and women's teams taking their place to comply with Title IX. By this time, women were the majority of university students, and universities were butting up against the reality of Title IX compliance. The popular notion at the time was that it was a zero-sum game, that if women had more sports opportunities, then men would have fewer opportunities. Universities had a set amount of money that they would spend on sports, so there had to be winners and losers. But there was a gorilla in the room, and that was football. Football was a sport that was taking up most of the college athletes, upwards of 100 players on a roster. And even though football programs claimed that the revenue generated to the school made them indispensable, this could not be used as a reason to deny women athletic opportunities. And by the way, the argument was false. 80% of college football teams and almost all high school football teams lose money. Title IX does not require identical programs for men and women. Instead, it calls for effective accommodation of student interests and abilities. Likewise, it acknowledges that the amount of money spent differs by sport. So women's cross-country running can't be compared to men's football. However, women's basketball and men's basketball are the same sport, so there must be equal treatment and funding to meet the 11 provisions. With one viral TikTok showing the men's and women's weight room side by side at the 2021 NCAA Basketball Championship, Stanford University sports performance coach Allie Kirshner illustrated that even at the biggest tournament in college basketball, women still get substandard treatment. The men had a room full of weight and workout equipment, while the women had a couple of dumbbells and some yoga mats. Even at the NCAA basketball championship, almost 50 years after Title IX was passed, three of the 11 equal treatment provisions were being violated. Scholarships are the only area where the money split has to be proportional to the ratio of women and men's participation. As an example, if there is $200,000 available for scholarships and 40% of the student athletes are women and 60% of the student athletes are men, then $80,000 of the scholarship money is allocated to women and $120,000 of the scholarship money is allocated to men. In the 1971-1972 academic year, almost 4 million students participated in high school sports. Only 7% were girls. By the 2018-2019 school year, almost 8 million students participated in high school sports and 43% were girls. The numbers closely mirror collegiate athletics. Pre-Title IX, women made up 50% of college athletes, and now they make up 44% of college athletes. Remember, though, that women make up 60% of undergraduates, so the gap is actually much larger. Men, despite making up 40% of the undergraduate students, have 60,000 more sports opportunities in the college system than women do. Women of color are even less represented in collegiate athletics. BIPOC women are only 14% of all college athletes. We've come far, but we still aren't there. There's one area of collegiate sports that has actually gone backwards since Title IX, collegiate coaches. In 1971, 90% of women's collegiate teams were coached by women. The evolution of collegiate women's basketball is the story of a league, the Association for Intercollegiate Athletics for Women, that was dominated by female leadership. In 1982, the AIAW and the NCAA held competing championship tournaments. In the end, the NCAA prevailed and took over women's basketball, and with the takeover, men moved into leadership positions. Now, only 41% of NCAA women's teams have a woman coach, and only 24% of athletic directors are women. And the number is downright dismal when it comes to BIPOC women. 7% of head coaches of women's teams are BIPOC women, and 4% of athletic directors are BIPOC women. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. Today's show is about Title IX, the legislation that mandated women have equal opportunity in education and sports. In the 2020 Tokyo Olympics held in 2021 due to the pandemic, American April Ross, along with her teammate Alex Kleinman, won the gold medal in beach volleyball. It was April's third Olympic medal, having won a silver in the 2012 Olympics and a bronze in the 2016 Olympics. After her Tokyo win, she said, "Without Title IX, I don't think I would be here. I firmly believe I wouldn't be where I am without my experience playing college sports at USC. It taught me so much, and I am extremely grateful for all the women and men who came before me that fought for my right to compete at college and have my education paid for." Although there is still a lot of work left to be done, it is undeniable that the playing field has expanded to allow women to pursue their athletic dreams. And it can be argued that there was a spillover into the international community. The Olympics are a prime example. In 1964, 13% of the athletes at the Tokyo Olympics were women. In 1972, the year Title IX passed, it had slightly increased to 15%. 12 years later at the LA Olympics in 1984, women made up 23% of the athletes, and Joan Benoit Samuelson became the gold medalist in the first time running of the women's marathon. At the 2020 Tokyo Summer Olympics, 49% of the athletes were women. Tokyo was the fourth Summer Olympics in which American women won more medals than American men, and the third consecutive Summer Olympics where American women outnumbered American men. The 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics was the second Winter Olympics where American women won more medals than American men. Women are becoming sports stars too. Before Title IX, there would be a random woman who became well-known as an athlete, like Babe Didrikson-Zaharas, the multi-sport athlete who won two gold medals in track and field and excelled at golf, basketball, and baseball. Wilma Rudolph, the Olympic gold medal sprinter from Tennessee, who had polio that left her unable to walk without a brace as a child. Or Catherine Switzer, who famously became the first woman to officially run the Boston Marathon, despite an attempt by the race directors to stop her while she was on the course. In the 1970s and 80s, women's sports stars were mostly Olympians in gymnastics, like Nadia Comaneci and Mary Lou Retton, or figure skating like Dorothy Hamill, or swimming like Janet Evans, or runners like Florence Griffith Joyner, who made a big enough impact to coin a nickname, FloJo. For the first time, we began to see the intense moments of women's competition, like Julie Moss crawling across the finish line of the 1982 Ironman triathlon, or Mary Decker and Zola Budd's famous tangle on the track that left Decker out of the competition and yelling in pain and frustration. In Alaska, we had Roxy Wright and Libby Riddles and Susan Butcher, who all made significant and long-lasting impressions on the sport of mushing. Rower Chris Thorsness, the first Alaskan to win an Olympic medal. And Nina Kempel, the perennial Nordic Olympian who inspired Alaskan boys and girls to take up cross-country skiing and dream big, building the foundation for Alaska to become a Nordic skiing hotbed of talent. But the 1990s and the beginning of the new century really saw the cult of women's sports personalities begin to explode. And not just in individual sports, but in team sports. In basketball, Lisa Leslie, Dawn Staley, Cheryl Swoops. In soccer, Mia Hamm, Michelle Akers, Brianna Scurry, and of course, Brandi Chastain, who in 1999 famously ripped off her shirt and celebrated the second World Cup win by an American team. The picture of Chastain celebrating is considered by many to be the most famous and impactful sports image ever. And now the names come easier, and in all sports, Megan Rapinoe, Simone Biles, Ronda Rousey, Katie Ledecky, Lindsey Vonn, Allyson Felix, Brittany Grenier, Corey Cogdell, and the ones who only need a first name for you to know who they are, Serena and Venus, and of course, Keegan. 50 years later, the playing field is still not level, but it is getting closer. In February of 2022, USA Soccer agreed to pay the women's national soccer team $24 million in an equal pay lawsuit where the U.S. Soccer Federation claimed that players should not be paid as much because they had less physical ability and responsibility than the men's team. The women's national team has 4 World Cup wins to 0 World Cup wins by the men's national team and has generated more revenue than the men's team since 2016. If you can name a United States national soccer player, chances are it is a player on the women's team. United States senators came to the defense of the USA women's hockey team in their pay dispute in 2017 by citing the Ted Stevens Olympic and Amateur Sports Act. Stevens had always been a promoter of girls and women in sports and was one of the co-sponsors of Title IX during its passage. He sponsored the original Sports Act in 1978 and the updated act in 1998. The act requires teams to, quote, provide equitable support and encouragement for participation by women where separate programs for male and female athletes are conducted on a national basis. In the end, the NHL quietly agreed to help USA Hockey fund the women's national team. When we think of Title IX, we think of the push and pull of progress for women in intercollegiate sports, which was certainly the dominant debate until 2011. Since then, there have been other areas where Title IX has expanded its reach. Title IX has been used by victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault to pursue sanctions against their assailants and reparations from their universities. Title IX has been used as the basis for allowing transgender students to access the appropriate bathrooms in primary and secondary schools. The hottest issue now is transgender athlete participation in the appropriate gender category. No doubt we will soon see Title IX challenges around intersex athletes. Women who are incarcerated have made Title IX challenges in order to access the same programs that are in men's prisons. And potentially it could be used to bring women's prison recreation opportunities on par with men's recreation opportunities. Many prisons receive federal funds for education, which means they too must provide equal opportunities to women in all of their programs. In future shows in the series, I will explore these more recent applications of Title IX. One of the sports that embodies the impact of Title IX over the last 50 years is wrestling. In the next segment of the show, you'll hear from Chloe Ivanoff, a standout Kodiak High School wrestler who went on to earn All-American status while wrestling at college. Her enthusiasm for wrestling has been channeled into creating wrestling opportunities for girls around Alaska. Before my interview with Chloe, we'll take a short break. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media, and I'm your host, Lisa Keller.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest in the next segment is Chloe Ivanoff. Chloe wrestled in high school and college, earning All-American status at both levels. She came back to Alaska and is now passing on her passion for wrestling to the next generation of girls. When I first began my interview with Chloe, I only anticipated using parts of the interview, so you won't hear my usual greeting and closing. Instead, we will just dive right in. So you were born in 1991, and were you born in Kodiak?
No, but I grew up here my whole life. It was kind of like a during the fishing season type of like my mom left the state to go get help because she had lots of kids. So okay. I was born somewhere else, but it was just more like convenience of the fishing season when my dad was gone. It's kind of funny.
Okay, yeah.
so it's like I wasn't born here, but sometimes I feel like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know.
That's kind of a unique thing. You know, I mean, yeah. I think that's a very Alaskan thing to like be part of the natural ebb and flow of the seasons. And so sometimes your birth isn't going to line up with being, you know, where your parents are really staying, you know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes it's not the most convenient time. And when you have extra kids and the extra help is out providing, you know, it's like Anyways, yeah, kind of funny.
Yeah. So then, but you've spent the majority of your life in Kodiak.
Yeah. And a couple winters, like, going to school. I went to school at Simon Fraser my first 2 years where I wrestled, and then I transferred to UAA. So I spent a couple winters there to finish my degree. And then I actually spent like 2 or 3 winters down south. But I've never spent a full year away from Alaska ever.
Okay. And so when you were growing up, did your parents introduce you to sports, or, I mean, you were just running around outside all the time probably. And then you have a fishing lifestyle. So, and that was from your parents, right?
Yeah. My dad is a fisherman. I think it's pretty hard not to be connected to the fishing industry somehow, especially in Kodiak. That's a big employer in our community. As far as sports go, my mom taught gymnastics, like rec gymnastics, here growing up, and so we were always during the summers, or there was like, you know, camp, kind of gymnastic camps going on, and then during the winter time we were always at the gym with her. But it was like not really there's no real set space for, there wasn't at the time, for gymnastics. So we were always like every day, unless they were doing a gymnastics unit at the elementary schools, but every practice rolling and unrolling up mats. Like Saturdays we'd put up the uneven bars and get out the beam. Like, you know, it's kind of funny, like every week it was definitely lots of parents involved helping and stuff. So, mm-hmm. So I grew up doing that. And then my brothers wrestled, and I was a bit of a tomboy, I would say. And I, in sixth grade, I tried like peewee football essentially. And I really loved it. And I was like, okay, what's the next like real physical sport? I'll try wrestling. And then, I really liked it. And then I continued through middle school, high school, and as well into like 2 years of college.
So you were an All-American in high school and college, right?
Yeah. I don't know how they did it exactly in high school, but I went to one like girls nationals, I think like when I was in ninth grade, and you get a certain placing, earn it, and then I think that would be all American status. And I don't know how many like competition or what sort of competitions would give that all-American status in high school, and maybe perhaps it's changed now, but there was like I think it was that year that happened, my ninth grade year.
I'm imagining, I did watch a clip of you wrestling. And it's something I never did, you know, and I did acrobats and ballet when I was a kid, but I didn't do gymnastics, you know, and I really definitely went more of like running and swimming and, you know, skiing were my main sports. But I'm imagining that your gymnastics background played a huge role in what kind of wrestler you became, because you definitely have to be super flexible too. I was amazed at what you and your opponent were doing, the flexibility that you had.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. I was never really super flexible, but I think what goes, you know, gymnastics can go hand in hand with wrestling, in that it's like a really, powerful sport, you know, like those short bursts of like speed and power. But and also in wrestling we do a lot of like tumbling and warm-ups and stuff, and with girls, being flexible is definitely like something that you don't see as much in the guys, like just mm-hmm. girls naturally are more flexible. I actually was really into running too. So
going to bring that up, because one of the articles I saw was about, is it Pillar Mountain? The Pillar Mountain?
Yeah. Pillar Mountain's a mountain here. Yeah.
It described you as like the queen of Pillar Mountain or something. Have you won it a couple times or?
I have won a couple times. It's not, I mean, it's a small community here. Like we don't get huge numbers, I think, for a lot of the, like some of the races in Anchorage. So though, but yeah, it's just a really fun race that if I have done a decent amount of training or I'm not, you know, injured or something, I like to do because there's, it's just a really fun event. And then they also have, I always get an ice cream afterwards. It's the tradition. So
yeah. And as an aside here, which you might not know, so your coach in high school was Marcus Dunbar, right?
Yep.
So Marcus, you might not know this, but Marcus and I have known each other since we were like 14 and 15 or 13 and 14.
Oh, did you go to the same high school maybe?
Well, he went to Bartlett and I went to East, but and I was a year ahead of him, but we ran together, obviously not together, but you know, we were close enough rivals, Bartlett and East. So we knew a lot of the Bartlett kids and we knew a lot of the West kids too, because we were also close. But so we hung out quite a bit, like in high school and post high school, what happened is he was going, I can't remember if he was at University of Portland or Portland State, but I was at University of Oregon and I was a year ahead of him. And so his junior year, he transferred to University of Oregon. And so, and that was my senior year. So we hung out a lot that year. I mean, we would, we had a swim conditioning class together and then we would go to, you know, there was an all you could eat spaghetti on Tuesday nights that we would go to. And there's same night, there's Prince Puckler's 99-cent Sundays. And so we've, and we're still in, we disagree on some things. So we get in a little fights about that, but we're still good friends. And his wife's main name is actually Keller and her family is from Montana, which was where my dad was from. So we were always kind of imagining that there had to be some sort of connection. Somehow. Yeah. Hasn't come up on 23andMe yet though. So, so
have you guys both taken the test though?
That's... I don't know if she has, I should ask her because because it seems like there's gotta be some connection there.
Yeah.
So anyway, yes. I know Marcus and Kathleen really well. So.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. He's, this is really fun to have as a coach. We had like, you know, the, summer track and field program, like I don't know, sometime early elementary school you can join it. So saw
he is definitely that, and then he is really committed to running. So
he's it's kind of funny coming now, I'm helping coach them and thinking of some of those coaches are just there year round, you're like holy cow, and then they also have their like their families and their own jobs. I'm like, man, how to find the balance, but obviously there's like, you can see, you know, they really, really love it, but it also, that's the way to grow like a really strong program too. It's like,
You used the word tomboy and that used to be used a lot when I was young too, because I would have been what was considered a tomboy. Do you think that's a term that is used as much anymore? Or do you think that we're at this kind of point where it's just accepted that girls are gonna do the same sports as boys and do the same activities as boys, at least in Alaska?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I mean, I think people, if you use it now, people like really know, still know what it means. So, you know, I don't know if it has like the same, I don't know if it's probably used as much anymore because now that there's, in certain sports, like in particular wrestling, there's a sanctioned girls division. It's like, the whole environment is like, has, changed, I think. Like it's not, I mean, it's definitely male dominated. It's a very like masculine space overall, but like even with them sanctioning the sport, like it has changed the environment a lot where you don't have to be like a tomboy to be a wrestler. You don't have to like, I feel like try to blend in. And I feel like that was kind of what you, when I was in high school and even women who were wrestling or they were girls at the time wrestling, on an all males team, like we've just talked about how it's, you're just like, sometimes just happy to be there. Well, I mean, I know I had a really welcoming, welcoming environment, but like, I know some other, women have like maybe not had that, but they're just happy to be there. And what I'd say for me, it was like, I would try to blend in, like, you know, feminine, super feminine clothing. Like you're not, you know, maybe you're just wearing more like neutral colors, or you're not wearing anything flashy and pink. And that was my feeling. You're just trying to blend in a little more. And then now when I go to the tournaments and stuff, it's just so cool to see like girls, you know, being girls. It's like more, it's just like a way different environment. And I think it's more fun and inviting. And, you know, I think it was a challenge to get the sport sanctioned in the state of Alaska. And there's still, I don't know how many states have it sanctioned now, over 30. I don't think
I saw a flyer that you, I think was to get girls out to wrestle in Kodiak. It said over 30 states have sanctioned the sport, including Alaska.
Yep. Alaska is one of them. I don't think we're up to 40, but yeah, I'm not quite sure what the number is, but it's like, it's increased so much. But I think that initially before it was sanctioned in Alaska, they're like, oh, well, you know, are we even going to get the numbers? And it's like, okay, you create this space and they will come. Like,
right.
You know, I almost teared up when I saw the first girls state championship in Alaska. I was like, this is crazy. It's just like, you know, there's, it was just so different from when I was in high school. We had like a, obviously no girls division. And it was so great to be able to wrestle in that space, but obviously there's just not as many females in it if you have to wrestle guys. And depending on what weight class you're in, it's going to just be more differences in strength, I think, compared to, you know, the much lighter weight classes versus the bigger, because not always, but in a lot of the lighter weight classes, oftentimes you'll get like the younger boys. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some like upperclassmen who are in the really late weight classes, but a lot of times like 103, 112, actually those weight classes might be different now.
You were 112, right?
Yep. I was 112.
Yeah. So yeah, I can totally see that, because the boys really haven't matured yet and they're probably going to add some pounds later on anyway. But the girls are probably right at maturity. You're full on, you know, you've got your body pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just like a generalization. There's obviously like people who might stay in that weight class their entire high school career, but like you have a lot more of the younger guys in those classes. So I think that has been in the past, like where some of the girls in the boys division have done well is at the lighter weight classes. Not saying they can't do well in other spots, but that's just like where there's been more success.
So I'm trying to remember, there was, there was no girls division when you were wrestling in high school. So you were wrestling against boys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you were more comfortable doing that because you had brothers. You probably wrestled against them, right?
Yeah. I don't know what, I think it was also just kind of, having brothers in it, that were supportive. And there, my team was really inviting, all the coaches and stuff. I was really, you know, lucky in that sense. And too bad that's a wording you have to use, like unlucky and lucky. You'd think like every space would maybe be inviting to people who want to try the sport. But I think I just seemed exciting to try something like very physical and also that not a lot of girls were doing. I think that honestly was kind of exciting. It's like a sport you don't see many girls in. And then, and I also was really into other sports at the time, but like, I think having that physical outlet was, you know, for your get to do it, double A's and take people down, it's like, was really fun for me.
There was, and I should have looked this up and checked beforehand, but I distinctly remember, I can't remember this gal's name, who won the boys, or won the division. I shouldn't say the boys division, because it was before the girls had their own division. But she was the first one to be a state champion. What is her name?
Michaela Hutchison. She was a legend. There's a couple like lady legends in the state for that, but Michaela was the first girl in the U.S. to win a boys state championship, and I think that was when I was in middle school. Her whole family is like super talented in wrestling, and my brother, I want to say he was like a senior in high school maybe when that happened, and he was saying it was just like the gym was so packed, and like, I mean, it was just a really intense moment. And he was like, yeah, I don't know if I'd want to be the boy in that. Like, I think it sounded like most people were, you know, I wasn't there, but it sounded like it was very, like, they wanted her to win. Like she was like the crowd favorite. I wasn't there. That's just what I heard.
Well, I mean, I'm like not into wrestling at all. Know very little about it. Wasn't part of my family culture. But I remember, cause I have two daughters, so they were young when that happened. And I remember I might've seen a video clip or something of when she won. And I remember like, I teared up, cause to me, it was like such a huge thing to see a girl being able to do what she loved to do and being so successful at it. And then I did think about like the example she was creating for all the girls that are coming after her.
Yeah. Like, you know, I mean, also showing that there's like, you know, just like you could still have success as a girl, like some people who are, you know, not into women or females entering the male space might be like, oh yeah, they can't be successful or, mm-hmm. That was just super exciting. Yeah. And, we had another one too, Hope Stephenson, she was after, I think, it was after I had graduated. She was from Kenai and I think she won the 103. And then we had some state placers, Michaela's older sister, I think placed at state. I'm not entirely sure. I don't know for sure. And then we had, Taylor O'Donnell, she placed at state too at 119, I believe. And she's the first Olympic wrestler from Alaska.
Oh, that's really cool. That gives me chills.
Yeah, she made the first Olympic team. She's also another legend that we have in the state. Lucky to have.
And in the United States is, I think I saw something that said that we're pretty dominant force in Olympic wrestling, right? We're like the one that everybody's going for, trying to be.
The U.S. is quite the powerhouse. We've definitely, I think the depth of the women's programs in the U.S. has grown, and there's more like different training centers around the states that are kind of connected to like the university system or connected to a university. And I think that has helped a lot, besides you're not just having like maybe one place to train, like there's different opportunities to train for women who are looking to go to the next level. There's some really talented women here. And that's pretty fun to see.
So you get all these girls and then who become women and continue to wrestle, but you really kind of need to also build this bigger infrastructure, which you are part of by your girls' wrestling camp, which has been, I was amazed when you told me the numbers of girls that come out for this wrestling camp. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. There's this organization called Alaska Girls Wrestle that Taylor, the Olympian from Homer, who's helped start with a couple of other women from around the state, Daisy Woodfork, Vanessa Gonzalez, and Lisa Kattler. So they were already had kind of started this. I don't know exactly how long it had been going, not too long. And then when I joined, we started planning for this camp, and we really were trying to think of the type of camp we wanted to bring. Like, we wanted a lot of sports camps can kind of be geared to like certain athletes who maybe have maybe they're already really good, or they, you know, they have the money to attend, or that, like the camps can just be really expensive. So we right. wanted to as best as we could, connect girls with resources, help them get to the camp. 'Cause there's like some really, really talented wrestlers from like rural areas. And it's like, you know, super expensive to fly to Anchorage. And then also even like, okay, you get there, how, like, transportation and where to stay. So, and even reaching out to all these communities who are, I mean, we didn't get everywhere, but tried to reach out to as many as we could, just to like, hey, we're having this camp. We know you got some, you know, some girls, are they interested? Like, how can we help make this happen? And, you know, sometimes like there's, you know, bad internet connection at the kid's house, so they have to go to the school to sign up for it. There's all these, it's just like, there was a lot of challenges to get girls there, but there's a lot of girls that went to that camp from all over the state. And I think, that felt really good to get more like, by putting in that effort, we got, a wider population of our girl wrestlers. And it was so fun to meet all them too, like get to know some of these people, maybe you, especially from more rural areas, maybe you don't see them at get to see them except for state or something, so mm-hmm. it's fun to like get to know more of the community.
Yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah, it also, the other thing that's really cool about that camp is it was a freestyle camp, which as you continue in the sport for women in college, it's freestyle. And so some girls maybe don't have the opportunity to like get introduced to freestyle. And it's like, it can be quite a tricky transition to like go from the high school style, folk style, which the boys wrestle in college, but the girls don't.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. That's how it is in the States. And in like Canada, they're doing freestyle in high school and college. But yeah, anyways,
do you know what the justification for that is? Or
I think that's just traditionally what the style has been for high school, like even before females entered it. And I think a lot of countries have their own, like another style of wrestling. Like, you know, in the US we have folk style, like, I mean, I don't know all the different styles of, but like Japan also does like sumo and stuff. Like, even India has like its particular type of wrestling style, but so a bit of countries have different styles. But the international, like one that you see at the Olympics and like world championships is like freestyle and then also Greco, but they don't have a women's division in Greco yet.
Anyways. Yeah. Things are changing though.
Yeah. So I think it's just traditionally what has gone in high school. Maybe we'll see like high school freestyle tournaments pop up versus state sanctioned events or whatever. But we'll see.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like a lot of fun ahead in the decades ahead. It's really exciting to see, you know, all these changes happening still.
Yeah.
I mean, we still have a ways to go and things still aren't, you know, where they need to be, but they're definitely, it's just, you can just see the wave coming. Like, mm-hmm. I just love this, the comments you made about seeing girls show up, how girls are at wrestling. They, you know, and it makes me kind of think of Keegan, and maybe the reason why she went the pink hair thing, you know, is just like, hey, I'm a woman and I can be a badass too. So
yeah, like it's refreshing to see like girls just being who they are. Like,
yeah.
And it's hard to say, like, you know, if I was in high school, maybe I would have still just been more like neutral colors or whatever, maybe not wearing pink and blah, blah, but, definitely a different environment where you I don't know. I don't feel like they feel like they have to blend in. At least
yeah.
what I've observed, you know.
If you are just joining us, you are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Lisa Keller. My guest in this segment is Chloe Ivanoff, and we are talking about girls wrestling in Alaska. Okay, so final question. What does Title IX mean to you?
More opportunities, try new things that you would maybe in the past wouldn't have got to try. Growth of a sport that I love, you know, like, which in turn creates more opportunities for girls in the future. And also even can help men's programs as well. I know some, programs have, well, I don't know actually how many programs have died. I know with, men's wrestling, typically having the women's program there has helped it.
Oh, good.
And I know so with some high school programs, when the women's female numbers have increased, like the boy side has as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it means more opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
That's
actually really good to hear because, you know, one of the perceived threats to Title IX has always been that men's programs are going to have to be cut in order to accommodate women's programs. And I think we're in an especially tricky part of our period of time because 60% of incoming freshmen, if you look at all colleges, are women. So that means 60% of your resources for sports in college need to go to the women. And so what do? I've heard a lot about wrestling, men's wrestling getting cut. But it's really more at the expense. The reason why they're getting cut is really because of football. Cause unfortunately football takes so many resources and
yeah, those teams are huge.
They're huge teams. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that what you've seen is that a women's wrestling program brings in more men too.
I don't know for, I guess I couldn't speak for maybe all the teams like, but right. I think that it's like by putting energy into growing the women's side, I think that's helped the men's side as well. I really do.
I love that. That's perfect. That's it for today's show. Thanks to my guest, Chloe Ivanoff. You can find links to Alaska Girls Wrestle, the Women's Sports Foundation, a video of Chloe wrestling, and a picture of the Patsy Takamoto Mink statue in Honolulu on the Outdoor Explorer page on alaskapublic.org. The show was produced by Eric Bork. My name is Lisa Keller, and from all of our hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thanks for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.